our next presentation is by Nick T. Berger from the University of Melbourne and Rachel Hendry from Western Sydney Youth, who is not here, I assume. Sonorizing and visualizing archive records.
Thanks very much. So we all know how valuable the audio records are that we work with or that we produce. And this is a particularly acute example of Fanny Cochran-Smith, who was a speaker of a Tasmanian language in Australia, recording what is perhaps the only recording we have of a Tasmanian language. And so it's quite an iconic picture. And if you go to the museum in Hobart in Tasmania, you'll find the same picture, but also the little wax cylinder recordings that were made with Fanny Cochran-Smith. And so there are somewhere in the order of 5 minutes or 6 minutes of recordings, and that's all there is recorded of Tasmanian Aboriginal language. So, looking at a wax cylinder doesn't tell you very much about what's on it. Looking at audio tapes doesn't tell you much about what's on them. Our project in Australia was to find as many recordings as we could, analogue recordings, and digitise them before it was too late. So we set up Paradisic, the Pacific and Regional Archive of Digital Sources in Endangered Cultures, which has now been going for 14 years. You can see the density of items in the collection is really focused on sort of Southeast Asia, the Pacific, and northern countries to the north of Australia, but we accept material from all over the place. The collection has, at the moment, material from over 1,000 languages in various forms, some of it audio. About half of it would be audio. You can see it's a significant, large collection with 7,000 hours of audio. So navigating this kind of material is a challenge. Obviously, we have metadata. But what do you do when you've got recordings, going back to the 1950s, textual material and highly valuable cultural material for the people who are recorded? And, who previously could never get access to this because it was sitting in a researcher's office. But now it's available, it's there on the web, but there's still more to be done. And these are typical tapes that we get, right? So this is the metadata that we have here and here. So what can you do with this? I mean, what we do is we digitise it and we put it online with this information. And if we have contextual information about the collection, we put that online as well. But there are lots of collections of tapes like this. This is the Solomon Islands Museum. There are agencies in our region who they're under-resourced. They don't have tape playback machines. And they have big collections of tapes that often are unique. And they're sitting in the tropics. So you know what happens to tapes when they're sitting in the tropics? They start going mouldy. So we've been working together with agencies like this to digitise their tapes. You need textual metadata to be able to navigate to find materials, and ideally if there are textual transcriptions, that's the gold standard, so that you can navigate through the contents of the recordings themselves. So let's look at how archives present audio to users, and I'm not dumping on archives here, I'm just saying this is what the current sort of best that we can do. And archives are completely overworked, I sympathise completely with them, so but, what you typically get, this is LR at the moment, you get to a WAV file. WAV files are, of course, the archival standard, but they're huge. And if you're in a village using a mobile phone, you're going to chew up, a year's worth of bandwidth to pull one file down. So delivering WAV isn't great. And if you're not using HTML5, which you're not if you're delivering a WAV file, then you can't do seeking into that file. It means that to play this file, you have to start here and wait till it gets to 46 minutes to hear the whole file. Now, that's not an ideal way of delivering a file. Dobez, if you've used Dobez, you know that it's got very rich metadata, which means that you have to navigate down trees and trees and trees of information to find the thing that you're interested in. And when you do, you have to download the audio, right? And if there's a transcript, often it's presented to you as an XML file. So these things are very difficult to deal with and to navigate. Our catalogue, at the moment, also doesn't do well, but we do transcode everything to MP3 so that you can play it through this way. And we've just developed a new system where transcripts, if they're available, will be played in sync if they're time-aligned, and you can seek to points within the MP3 file, so you can leap around. But even here, you're leaping around an unknown space. You don't don't know what's in there. You're sleeping around hoping that you'll find something. So what you could do is use something like WaveSurfer, which gives you an indication of where there's noise, where there's something happening in the file. But it's not particularly informative. We don't know if that's one speaker or two speakers. We don't know if there's background noise or not. Really, it's just giving us a wave signal. So we've been experimenting with combining spectrographic information with a sort of wave form. And we've come up with something like this, where you can look inside a file. So if there is some metadata that says there are three speakers on this file or there is a music event on this file, that you can see, okay, there's something different happening here. I can move my slider along to this point and listen at that point. So it's giving us another point of access to this media. The algorithm for producing this we call NoiseViz, and it's available, the source is available if for other language archives if they want it. It's still not completely implemented in the collection, but this is the direction that we want to move in to try and present audio with some visual images. Another thing that we've been doing is working on EOPAS, which some of you may have seen. EOPAS is a way of presenting interlinear text and media. Now, this is, as they say, deprecated. It's no longer really in development, and we've got Cratalos being developed and other things which I think are going to take the place of this. But the basic concept that if we do have interlinear text and we have media, we should be able to look at all this together. We shouldn't have, ideally, you know, get a PDF file and have to listen to something looking at a PDF file that doesn't tell you where you are. This scrolls through and shows you where you are in relation to the media, and ideally it gives you a citation form so that at any point you could cite this particular sentence if you wanted to present it in a talk or send it to somebody and say, this is the sentence I'm talking about, listen to this. So presenting the information in the collection. So EOPAS presents these single interactive pages. But what we can do then is capture those pages as videos and use them as a trigger in an augmented reality display. So this is a thing that is currently on a museum in Australia. So we're exploring this. This is still quite new. But each of these is a trigger for an augmented reality event. And in the poster session at lunchtime, I'll have this running so you can see it with an iPad. But the event is the EOPAS instance that I just showed. So it's a story in a language. And each of these is a different language. So it just gives people a bit of an idea of what different languages sound like. And, you know, for many people, the idea that there are different languages is a revelation to begin with. And then listening to them, of course, gives them a bit of a sense of what they're like. Let's see if I can get this working.
I just mean how I pain.
So that's one of the things that we've been doing to sort of explore how to present the information in the collection. And another one is using virtual reality. So we engaged a games developer, who's an artist as well. We went through the collection and we went 5 minutes into an audio file in the collection, we snipped 20 seconds and we generated 7,000 snippets of audio files from the collection to use in a virtual reality display. Now the beauty of this is that each of the files is named as per the collection item, so all the metadata is maintained and we have geographic information for each of those files as well. We realised we needed to listen to some of those, well, to all of those files, because we didn't know what was in there, right? That's the whole problem. You go 5 minutes into a file and you snip 20 seconds, what is it? And we did that by employing a student assistant to listen to the files. And sampling those 7,000 files ended up in 200 files that we wanted to use. And the criteria, we didn't want to duplicate languages. We wanted to have one per language. We wanted it to be interesting, not elicitation, not the linguist talking. Some of the files were blank at that point. Anyway, we ended up with 212 files, which had some good value. And we're going to run this again on every second file and see if we can create more information. The sort of things that we're finding, though...
And then this one.
Potong dengan pisau. Ada pisau dan potong begitu, potong tali, umpamanya.
And this one.
Karena awal mandi, awal pekerja.
So what's wonderful is actually the quality of these recordings. You can see these are going back to 1960, 1970, 1972. So a tribute to the recorders who did a good job and to the digitisation process that's produced a really good, faithful copy of this. So you don't get a whole lot of hissing and rubbish in the background. So then what we're doing with this is putting it into a virtual reality display. Now, my colleague Rachel Hendry has a project which is involving a whole lot of other universities, and they're building a dome which allows you to sit inside the dome and to have various kinds of information displayed above you. You may be familiar with these kinds of things. They're quite beautiful. You can be immersed in environments that people can't go into anymore. So, you know, caves that Lascaux Caves and other places like that that we no longer can go into, but we can experience through these virtual realities. And we wanted to do something like this. You want? Go inside a giant louse. But these can be delivered either using these giant domes, or they can be delivered using virtual reality headsets, which are quite expensive, but, you know, we're at the beginning of this. There are cardboard versions of these, of course. I think that's one here, which are very cheap. So we're sort of exploring this. I'm not suggesting this is the solution for everybody, but I think it's very interesting to try it out. So what we've done is, for every language that we have, we also have information about the documentation of that language, which comes from OLAC. So building on Sebastian's talk previously, because we have those three-letter codes, we can pull information from various places. And we can pull information about how much information there is about the language and display that. We can get information about numbers of speakers. And obviously there's geography as well. So that's what we've done. We've built a display, which I'll show you in a minute, which allows you to fly over a virtual landscape, a landscape, geography. And everywhere there's a language, you'll see a dome and you'll see a spike. And the spike, if you navigate towards it, will play you, if there is one, a snippet in that language. So I'll just show you that.
So gamora na kibana mle manum bune no. So long na mle no.
Rolongen, rolongen sins arngen rahabuin. Rolongen sins arngen rahabuin ni moro tilam lingling. Etingur ni sungsung yani. Roko roko tan nimbung ni ni. Nimbung nini hap-hapi ni tevis, etro longgen, longer sense arngen rahapen, longer sense arngen rahapen ni moro tilam lingling, etingku.
So long nanti nunggu dia so resuah. So kamera yang sekarang nunggu kanan bunen. So long nanti nunggu dia so resuah. So kamera yang sekarang nunggu kanan bunen. So long nanti nunggu dia so resuah.
So you can see that you've got this effect sort of walking through a forest of languages. And as you pass by, you're getting snippets of these languages. And with the virtual reality headset, you can focus in on one and just hear that one. Or if you want, you can just experience this richness of languages as you travel through this landscape. So this is Vanuatu. It's implemented for Melanesia, so including Papua New Guinea, and we can extend it. Of course, these things take up a lot of computational power. So the version you're looking at here is for iPad, so it's just limited to Vanuatu. But the one that's in the museum has a high-powered computer and has a lot more information in it. So, you know, do we need to do this kind of stuff? I think it's a very useful way of doing outreach. So this is all running in a museum in Canberra at the moment. It's a display about UNESCO's Memory of the World. Because Paradisic is registered in the memory of the world, this is a way of us presenting some of the information that we have. So there's a real research use for this, because we should be providing
language content for museum displays and not leaving it up to people who don't really know much about language. So this is a way of filling that gap. But the other thing is that this provides exposure for the material that's in these hidden collections inside archives. And hopefully, you know, maybe someone walking through the museum has a grandparent who speaks that language and they recognise that language. And then they can go back to the collection and say, well, actually, I'd like to provide some more metadata about this information because I recognise these speakers. We've got to extend the reach of these collections so that that can happen. So that we can, in the end, enrich all the material that's sitting in our collections and ultimately make it available for the whole world. And that's actually the end of it.
How do you deal with the issues of multilingualism? So, for example, in the three clips you initially were showing, the 20-second clips, the second one was Indonesian, and I'm not sure if that was intentional or not, but even if it was, I could see the problem where if someone looking at the clips or listening to the clips doesn't know the contact language or whatever, you know, there could be speakers of five different languages on them, and we've got it coded with one ISO code,
exactly.
How do we know what is being represented?
Yep. Exactly. And, well, that's the problem, right? We have the metadata that comes with a collection. So we have a collection that says it's recorded in Indonesia. We don't know what languages are involved. So then we end up with that. And the research assistant who listened to this, you know, knew some languages. But we have Tok Pisin, where it's meant to be a Papua New Guinean language. We have Bislama, where it's meant to be a Vanuatu language. So, exactly. These are problems that we have to try and fix. But the only way to fix them is to put it out there, look at it, and say, hey, that's not actually what we think it is. But, you know, when we ingest stuff into the collection, we just get tapes, we digitise them, and we put them in the collection. We don't listen to every tape. We couldn't possibly do that. But this is what I mean. We need this next step where we can expose it for crowdsourcing, for advice from people who know these languages to enrich the collection. Yeah.
Because I think that would be an important step, because if it's in a museum, I think that, you know, communities should have some involvement in what is being represented about their language.
The way the material comes into our collections is from a depositor who's typically a linguist who's developed a relationship with a community.
Mm-hmm.
They, in depositing, tell us that they have permission to do that.
Okay.
We can't. So being an archive, we don't have a direct relationship. You know, this is the thing. So there's this tripartite relationship, the community, the linguist, and the archive. And also, because we're only putting up small snippets, we think we're not doing anything... we hope we're not doing anything disrespectful. In general, in our collection, we have a takedown principle. So if people think there's material on there that that shouldn't be made public, they can get in touch and we can take it down. But in my experience, the problem is usually the opposite, that people whose grandparents or great-grandparents were recorded go to an archive and can't find the information that they want, or they're blocked from access to it. And that's when the frustration occurs. So I think you're right, but it's just physically, it's impossible for us. You know, we've got over 1,000 languages, and these come from very small communities that don't have any sort of communication, for us to talk to each of the source communities, or even the descendants of the speakers. That would be fantastic, but that would be a million-dollar research project in itself.
I got a nerd question.
Yeah.
What are you guys using as your... I'm a software developer.
Okay. I think it's Unity is the...
Is it going to be available generally?
I don't know how much of it's generic. That's the trouble, right? I mean, it's... seems that you build these things, and I'm not sure.
No, I mean, like, even like the build out, the binary, I guess, the executable.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Like, we're really just building it, and we're just running it. And it's a developer who's doing it, so it's not, I'm not sure.
Okay.
But do you think that's a good idea?
I think it's something I'm really interested in. I did a VR talk yesterday, and there's quite a few people who are doing VR and native languages, and I really like this concept of, you know, the forest of languages in VR that's made.
Well, so the potential is that if you like it and we could, I think basically you could strip out the geography and strip out the language
yeah.
stuff and put your own into it.
Well,
that
yeah,
might
I would
be
like
possible.
To see what you guys are doing now. That'd be
yeah.
interesting to
yeah.
do. I don't
sure.
want to copy code because you have your own processes and you have your own databases
yeah.
you're working with. Them.
Yeah. The input into is just a spreadsheet for the metadata.
Yeah.
It's not too difficult. We can talk more about
yeah,
it.
I'll
yeah,
I'll bug you when you
yeah.
do the process.
Yeah, yeah.
I have a question about use of MP3.
Yeah.
Two questions. One is, do people complain about loss of fidelity? And the second is, do you really find that seeking into a particular place works well? My experience is that I've got to switch to OGG if I want to be able to accurately seek into a file.
Yeah. I think HTML5 now is very good. And MP3 for human ears is amazingly good. We don't store MP3. We don't want people recording MP3. The archival version is actually 96 kilohertz, 24 bits. It's ridiculously overblown WAV file. So the MP3 is in the order of, you know, a 50th the size of it or something like that.
So you convert it as you're delivering it then?
No. We convert on ingestion. So when we ingest
okay.
a file, we create an MP3 for delivery. And my experience of seeking into MP3 actually is good. We used to use OGG, but that was in the old days.
Yeah, my experience is that it was off by a second or two on a long file.
Oh, okay.
So I switched to OGG and it's just fine.
Yeah.
That's fixed in browsers.
Yeah.
Well, my impression was it was the server that was making the mistake, not the browser.
Right.
Oh, it's streaming.
Yeah, we can talk about it. Because exactly the problem, if you've got timeline text, then it's critical that there is a proper alignment.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you. I was just curious if your developers and you know the team have a goal of distributing a non-internet version of this beautiful experience for people who don't have a lot of bandwidth.
Yeah.
And maybe you know share it around in the islands or other.
Yeah. Well, it's actually available for iPad now.
Oh, okay.
And so
oh, okay.
presumably for iPhone, but you know you can see an iPhone would be quite small. And presumably for Android tablets as well. But for the minute, I mean, you know, this was only done in the last few weeks that we had the iPad version, because it had to be stripped down to be able to run on the iPad. Yeah. Yeah.
I may have missed this, Nick, but I noticed when we were going through the forest of languages that occasionally it looked like there was data there that you could potentially
yes.
click on and get demographic data.
Yeah, there is. So there is a toggle for information about how much, so is there a grammar, is there a lexicon? And that, there is a bit of a readme in the display that tells you this.
So you can actually stop and...
You can turn it off. But the thing is, at the moment, it's not connected to our collection. But what would be very nice is if you could connect this so that when you're at a point and you hear something, you'd like to go to the original file.
Right.
So that would be something that would happen.
So you can hear and extend it.
You hear the whole thing,
yeah,
and see the context and read the metadata, yeah.
Do you think this technology had ever sense of representing sign data, so a visual component?
Of course, yeah, it would be exactly the same. So you'd be going through a forest of signs, you know, you could have videos popping up as you went through. I think that would be quite an easy, I mean, it would be conceivable.
Well, if not, there is a poster session.
Yeah,
later
at lunchtime we'll be
lunchtime.
The augmented reality, so
you can
look at that.
See it in reality or virtually.
Yeah.
So thank you, Nick.